strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate you spending some time with the show. A close ally, a legal ally of the Biden administration, is a Harvard law professor named Lawrence Tribe, who is saying that the vice president of the United States can't necessarily break the tie if it's a 50-50 tie in the Senate for an appointment to the Supreme Court. And I was one of the people that thought that they could. And there are a few. This is one of the legal arguments that's going on. And the reason why they say they have the vice president has that right, according to the Constitution, for passage of bills, but not for appointments. Now, whenever we have legal questions, we go to our KTAR News legal analyst, Monica Lindstrom. She joins us now. Can you shed a little bit of light onto what this argument is going to be? Did I sum it up fairly well, or is it a little deeper?
Yeah, no, you summed it up very well. So basically what happens is the vice president presides over the Senate, right? And if the Senate is going to vote and there's a tie, she is the tiebreaker, right? That's put out in the Constitution. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that she cannot cast the deciding vote when it comes to the appointment of a Supreme Court justice. There's nothing there. And in fact, if you look back in the history, there has been other times, I guess, from what I've read, where the VP has cast the deciding vote when it comes to appointments. So I understand that the Harvard professor, Lawrence Tribe, I believe is his name,
yep,
right? He's the one that said that she cannot break ties, but everybody else out there right now seems to be thinking, yes, she could, because there is no clear exception to the rule in the Constitution, and there's nothing that says that she can't. So chances are that if it's a tie and she casts the tie-breaking vote, there may be a lawsuit, but there doesn't really seem to be anything that says she can't.
Okay, so I know you're never supposed to ask someone to interpret what someone else is thinking, but I'm going to do it to you anyway. Why would somebody that's such a learned professor and an ally of the president, not a detractor of the president, where would he get this theory from?
Well, like all lawyers, right, we have different opinions. And so he's probably looking for something in the words or in the history where he could turn around and say, okay, she can't do this, right? And he's trying to find an answer, or maybe he's trying to just put an argument out there to get his name out there. I mean, that could be it too, you know. But it could also be maybe he wants to make it look like there's nothing shady going on at the White House, or that nobody has to worry about this, because Harris can't do this anyway, and so it takes some pressure off. Or, you know, he could just be crazy.
How
I, you know, I mean,
I didn't take that option into consideration, but you're right. Do you think, is it ironic, is it rare that the Supreme Court would have to then decide the case about the appointment of a Supreme Court justice like this?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yes. We come full circle with that, right? Here's what I think is even crazier, is that if Biden were to nominate VP Harris as the next justice, right, and the Senate ties on it, could she cast the deciding vote for herself? Now, that right there is an interesting question, because the decision or the explanation that I just gave, that there's nothing saying that she can't, so that means she could, but there's the court of public opinion and blah, 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 blah. So that's where it gets even crazier.
Yeah. Imagine if that happened and then there was a lawsuit and the justices on the court had to decide whether or not she was going to be on the court. It's like a Seinfeld episode.
It really is. Or the Twilight Zone, yeah, right?
Right.
But the rest of the process, Mike, is actually pretty simple. So the president, he comes up with a short list, right? And then they come up with a nomination. It goes to the Senate Judiciary Committee. They do the interviews. They do the hearings, which we've all seen and heard on TV in the past decade. And then it goes to the full Senate to vote. And then there we go.
Yeah. One of the interesting things, if you remember the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation, one of the things that happened was
can you forget? did.
Right. Well, it was also how public that part was about the sexual misconduct allegations, because I was told by John Kyle, the former senator who was on the Judiciary Committee, that that could have been handled behind closed doors. And often those hearings are when they go into a judge's background and they do that big investigation. Sometimes it's drugs or sometimes it's something else from their past. And they do it behind closed doors to see if they get a satisfactorily answered the questions, or if they eliminate the candidate. It's not done publicly all the time. Is that right?
That's funny. Yeah. Well, it could be. But the thing is we're dealing with the Supreme Court of the United States, right? The highest, most important court. And we're dealing with a very political atmosphere and everybody has an agenda. So that may happen at lower levels. I can never see that happening in the future when you're dealing with a Supreme Court justice.
So if there's ever questions about something in the background check, it will be handled very publicly so that it kind of everything, it's all outside in the light of day.
Does it have to be? No, but I think that it will be, especially when our society screams today for transparency.
Well, I always appreciate the time, and I always call you with weird questions on short notice, and you're always great about it, so I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Bye.
All right, that's Monica Lindstrom. She's the KTAR News legal analyst. She's also on the air quite a bit here, and we're lucky to have her. A brilliant legal mind and does a great job here in the Valley as a lawyer. And I just thought that was an interesting question and a theory from a lawyer that says he's an ally to the administration. Don't forget, coming up at 10:30, around 10:30, the White House has scheduled a press conference in which the President of the United States and Justice Breyer will have a press conference announcing the retirement of Justice Breyer. And we're going to carry those comments live here at KTAR News. It's scheduled to start at about 10:30. But what you should do is download the KTAR News app. When that is happening, you will be notified on your device that it's happening, and you can click on the device and you can listen live to the press conference and always be informed in all the important news that's happening. Coming up in a moment, we go back to our border conversation. Had an interesting conversation with a supervisor from Yuma County. What he said happened with Secretary Mayorkas yesterday that might give us hope at the border. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Hey, thanks so much. Appreciate you spending some time with the show. One of the big issues has been the border. People in Arizona understand, the people of Yuma County, especially right now, and across the border in Arizona and Texas, we know that there is a lot that's happening there. But Yuma really came into focus a few weeks ago when they had such a huge uptick in numbers of people that were crossing, thousands of people waiting to be processed, and we had Jonathan Lines on. Jonathan Lines is a supervisor with Yuma County. He was at one time the Republican Party chairman in the state of Arizona. So that's where I got to know Mr. Lines. And he came on with us a few weeks ago and kind of laid out and gave us a really good mental picture of what was happening at the border and how there was the plight of the people that were coming, the plight of the people of Yuma County, how their public services were being stretched in 911 calls and hospitalizations and jails, and that it was a very difficult time. And then even food banks were being stressed. So it was a picture that was painted. Well, Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas from Homeland Security was in Yuma and we had meetings. And the morning meeting did not go very well. It got a little contentious. And it was Border Patrol agents. I want you to hear just a little bit of this leaked message from the morning meeting where Border Patrol agents, some of them got a little contentious and even turned their back on the secretary.
Every time something important comes here, we rush out. We have 50 more buses that come in and they take as many people out of here as they can. You guys keep saying you want to see how it really is down here. Why do we keep sending as many people out of here as we can?
So what he's saying there, and it's really tough to hear, I understand, it's a little scratchy, is they're saying, why is it if you want to come down here and see what's really going on, that before you get here, they send 50 buses and they bus people out so that while you're here, you can't see what's going on? Basically saying it's a photo op, it's a sideshow. So I asked Jonathan Lines about this and asked him about how the meeting went. Was it contentious? And he said that it went very well, that he made commitments on repairing things. I want you to hear a little bit of what Mr. Line said, how this meeting went in the afternoon.
The mayor and I had the opportunity to sit down with him, and he turned the meeting over to us and listened to our concerns and complaints and wanted to understand our challenges and made commitments to us.
Well, did he commit to doing more for the Yuma sector?
Yes. First and foremost, our capital request was to complete the wall and to energize all of the resources, meaning specifically the lighting and plugging the holes in this area. He had his chief counsel there with him and the chief of the National Border Patrol, Mr. Ortiz, and the Yuma sector chief. And they talked about the different funding mechanisms already in place. And, you know, he was able to see the assets, meaning the rusting sections of wall that have been sitting there since the inauguration, and committed to getting those taken care of in a really short period of time.
So one of the things that I asked Mr. Lines was, does he believe that this is a policy shift? And he said, absolutely. He didn't go as far as to say the administration, but he said he believes that from the Secretary Mayorkas' position, there is a policy shift. He made a commitment to do certain things. And then he also said that there would be a Zoom meeting in the next couple of weeks so that he could update both the mayor and the supervisor on the progress and what was happening. So here's the two schools. Do I believe that this administration has changed its border policy and is going to do everything that's necessary to get control? No, I don't. I don't believe that. And I believe their policy is their policy. But I do believe that the people of Yuma have made their case well enough that some changes will be made. So anything that helps the people of Arizona and the people of Yuma County, and let's be really honest, for the people that are being preyed upon, that are being brought across the border, they're being lied to, they're spending money they don't have, their lives are endangered, the women are being assaulted in many cases, and then there's a lot of them are being sold into slavery. This is a horrible situation. It's going to lessen the ability for them to be trafficked as well. And it is a really difficult situation. So much of what's in here, in this story, it is people are asking that changes be made. And the administration has made, in my opinion, has made a lot of mistakes when it comes to the border. But any step in the right direction is one that's welcomed. And I was happy that Mr. Lines came on and explained what happened in that afternoon meeting. And he walked away, and he's a smart guy. This is not someone that's going to be easily duped by someone. And he is also someone, if this was all talk, and if in 3 or 4 weeks nothing is moving and nothing is happening, he will come back on the show and call it out. But to be fair, he said it seemed to be a definite shift in policy. What I didn't like about any of this is, to be fair, I don't like it when people snub leaders. You know, the way Mayorkas snubbed the governor was the wrong thing to do. It was the wrong thing to do. Republican governors have always welcomed Democrat presidents and Democrat leaders when they come to Arizona. It's a sign of respect. And if you're the governor of Arizona and there's a federal leader that comes in, you should at least let the administration know what your schedule is. You know, I mean, and that's what I've heard was that courtesy wasn't even extended. And these are the kinds of things that divide even further. All of this talk of unification, it's very simple. You know, we know about I joked about it earlier on the show, the scene on the airport tarmac where Governor Brewer waved her finger at President Obama. The governor of Arizona went and welcomed a Democrat president. It happened during the Bush years, during Bush 43, when he was in office with George W. Bush, where he would come to Arizona and our governor then, Janet Napolitano, would be busy. Once she was on vacation, she made a comment one time, if he wants to meet with me, I'll meet with him. But there was no acknowledgement that the president was coming. And I think that basic courtesy would be a way to start to bridge the gap that exists. And so I welcome the fact that Secretary Mayorkas was cordial and he was open to listening, and he says he's going to change some things because I believe the people of Yuma County deserve that. All along Arizona's southern border deserve to be safe and deserve to not be overrun with cartel members and drugs. And so let's just hope this is a step in the right direction. That to me would be the best of both worlds. What we are expecting to happen at around 10:30 is the president of the United States is scheduled to have a press conference with Justice Breyer, who is going to announce his retirement to the court. We are going to carry that live when it happens. But again, it's always in flux when the White House makes its way to the podium. And as soon as they do, we will carry it for you. So we'll all be back, and we got the news coming up in a few moments. Stick around. We are awaiting the arrival of the president and Justice Breyer. They had a meeting. The letter's been sent to the White House. It will be the official retirement announcement of Justice Breyer. And then I imagine the president's going to explain the process he's going to go through. Let's toss it to the president now.
Both Dr. Breyer, Dr. Biden, and for being here. And I can't tell you, this is sort of a bittersweet day for me. Justice Breyer and I go back a long way, all the way back to the mid-70s when he first came on the Judiciary Committee. But that's another story. I'm here today to express the nation's gratitude to Justice Stephen Breyer for his remarkable career of public service and his clear-eyed commitment to making our country's laws work for its people. And our gratitude extends to Justice Breyer's family for being partners in his decades of public service. In particular, I want to thank his wife, Dr. Joanne Breyer, who is here today and who has stood by him for nearly six decades, and with her fierce intellect, good humor, and enormous heart. I want to thank you. The country owes you as well. And Stephen Breyer's public service started early. He served in the United States Army as a teenager, and in all three branches of the federal government before he turned 40.
They were the good old days, weren't they?
And as he was a law clerk at Supreme Court Justice Goldberg, a prosecutor in the Department of Justice, a member of the Watergate prosecution team. And I first met Stephen Breyer when I was a senator on the Judiciary Committee, and he started off as taking care of one of the subcommittees for Teddy, but then became chief counsel during his tenure as Ted's chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee. Beyond his intellect and hard work and legal insight, he was famous for biking across Washington virtually every day for a face-to-face meeting with a Republican chief counsel, the ranking Republican counsel. And over breakfast, they discussed what would they do for the country together. Whereas in those days, we tried to do things together. That spirit stuck with me when I took over the Judiciary Committee as chair after Senator Kennedy's tenure. And it was my honor to vote to confirm Justice Breyer to serve in the United States Supreme Court, or the Court of Appeals first, in 1980. And then 14 years later, in 1994, I got to preside as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee over a Supreme Court confirmation hearings. We were joking with one another when he walked in. Did we ever think that he would have served decades on the court and I'd be president of the United States when the day he came in to retire? And he looked at it. Anyway, I won't tell you what he said. I'm joking. But I was proud and grateful to be there at the start of this distinguished career in the Supreme Court. And I'm very proud to be here today on his announcement of his retirement. You know, during his confirmation hearings way back in 1994, nominee Stephen Breyer said, quote, "The law must work for the people." He explained to us his faith that our complex legal system has a single purpose: tell people who make up our country. It was a different time, of course, but his brilliance, his values, his scholarship are why Judge Breyer became Justice Breyer by an overwhelming bipartisan vote at the time. Today, Justice Breyer announces his intention to step down from active service after four decades on the federal bench and 28 years on the United States Supreme Court. His legacy includes his work as a leading scholar and jurist in administrative law, bringing his brilliance to bear to make government run more efficiently and effectively. It includes his stature as a beacon of wisdom on our Constitution and what it means. And through it all, Justice Breyer has worked tirelessly to give faith to the notion that the law exists to help the people. Everyone knows that Stephen Breyer has been an exemplary justice. Fair to the parties before him, courteous to his colleagues, careful in his reasoning. He's written landmark opinions on topics ranging from reproductive rights to health care, to voting rights, to patent law, to laws protecting our environment, and the laws that protect our religious practices. His opinions are practical, sensible, and nuanced. It reflects his belief that a job of a judge is not to lay down a rule, but to get it right, to get it right. Justice Breyer's law clerks and his colleagues, as many of the press here know, describe him and his work ethic, his desire to learn more, his kindness to those around him, and his optimism for the promise of our country. And he has patiently sought common ground and built consensus, seeking to bring the court together. I think he's a model public servant in a time of great division in this country. Justice Breyer has been everything his country could have asked of him. And he's appeared before, when he appeared before the Judiciary Committee almost 3 decades ago, we all had high hope for the mark he would leave on history, law, and the Constitution. And he's exceeded those hopes in every possible way. Today is his day, our day to commend his life of service and his life on the court. But let me say a few words about the critically important work of selecting his successor. Choosing someone to sit in the Supreme Court, I believe, is one of the most serious constitutional responsibilities a president has. Our process is going to be rigorous. I will select a nominee worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence and decency. While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first Black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court. It's long overdue, in my view. I made that commitment during the campaign for president, and I will keep that commitment. I will fully do what I said I'd do. I will fulfill my duty to select a justice, not only with the Senate's consent, but with his advice. You've heard me say in other nomination processes that the Constitution says seek the advice and consent, but the advice as well of the Senate. I'm going to invite senators from both parties to offer their ideas and points of view. I'll also consult with leading scholars and lawyers. And I'm fortunate to have advising me in this selection process Vice President Kamala Harris. She's an exceptional lawyer, former Attorney General of the state of California, former member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I will listen carefully to all the advice I'm given, and I'll study the records and former cases carefully. I'll meet with the potential nominees, and it is my intention to announce my decision before the end of February. I have made no choice at this point. Once I select a nominee, I will ask the Senate to move promptly on my choice. In the end, I will nominate a historic candidate, someone who is worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy, and someone who, like Justice Breyer, will provide incredible service on the United States Supreme Court. Justice Breyer, on behalf of all the American people, I want to thank you and your family for your tremendous service to our nation. I'm going to yield the floor to you, Mr. Justice.
You are listening to the retirement announcement of Justice Breyer on KTAR News 92.3 FM.
Thank you, Mr. President. That is terribly nice. And believe me, I hold it right here. It's wonderful. And I thought about what I might say to you, and I'd like to say something I enjoy is talking to high school students, grammar school students, college students, even law school students. And they'll come around and ask me, what is it you find particularly meaningful about your job? What sort of gives you a thrill? And that's not such a tough question for me to answer. It's the same thing. Day one, almost, up to day, I don't know how many. But what I say to them is, look, I sit there on the bench, and after we hear lots of cases, and after a while, the impression, it takes a while, I have to admit, but the impression you get is, you know, as you well know, this is a complicated country. There are more than 330 million people, and my mother used to say it's every race, it's every religion, and she would emphasize this, and it's every point of view possible. And it's a kind of miracle. When you sit there and see all those people in front of you, people that are so different in what they think, and yet they've decided to help solve their major differences under law. And when the students get too cynical, I say, go look at what happens in countries that don't do that. And that's there. I can't take this around in my job. But people have come to accept this Constitution, and they've come to accept the importance of a rule of law. And I want to make another point to them. I want to say, look, of course people don't agree, but we have a country that is based on human rights, democracy, and so forth. But I'll tell you what Lincoln thought, what Washington thought, and what people today still think. It's an experiment. It's an experiment. That's what they said. And Joanna paid each of our grandchildren a certain amount of money to memorize the Gettysburg Address. And the reason that what we want them to pick up there, and what I want those students to pick up, if I can remember the first two lines, is that four score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought up, created upon this here a new country, a country that was dedicated to liberty and the proposition that all men are created equal. Conceived in liberty, those are his words, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He meant women, too. And we are now engaged in a great civil war to determine whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. See, those are the words I want to see. An experiment. And that's what he thought. It's an experiment. And I found some letters that George Washington wrote where he said the same thing. It's an experiment. That experiment existed then because even the liberals in Europe, you know, they're looking over here and they're saying it's a great idea in principle, but it'll never work. But we'll show them it does. That's what Washington thought. And that's what Lincoln thought.
All right, you've been listening to the retirement speech of Justice Breyer and the comments made by President Biden.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, I appreciate you spending some time with the show. If you have just tuning in, you missed the president speaking. President Biden spoke about the retirement of Justice Breyer and his career, about his time spent working in the government and then working in the Supreme Court as a clerk and then working on one of the lower courts and then eventually his appointment to be a justice on the Supreme Court. And then he gave the floor over to Justice Breyer to make some remarks about his retirement. But one of the things here that's got everybody kind of captivated and not concerned, but asking questions about is this going to be, who is this going to be, is the president saying who he is going to nominate.
Our process is going to be rigorous. I will select a nominee worthy of Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence and decency. While I've been studying candidates' backgrounds and writings, I've made no decision except one. The person I will nominate will be someone with extraordinary qualifications, character, experience, and integrity. And that person will be the first black woman ever nominated to the United States Supreme Court.
Now, I will tell you, I hear that and I think, you know, something like that's long overdue in this country. There's no doubt about it. And I look at that and think that's doesn't this move us forward towards equity and equality? All that's absolutely true. It's a poor analogy because the importance of the Supreme Court is far more important than any of these other things I'm going to give you examples of. But being a huge sports fan as I am, the big conversation in the NFL right now with all these openings are the very limited number of black head coaches there are in the NFL. And the agreement among people is that there are a lot of very qualified people. But even I was watching the Fox pregame show, and I think it was Michael Strahan who said, but it's got to be the right choice. In other words, yes, it should be someone because there are qualified people out there to get the nod. I'm talking about a coach in the NFL. How much more important is it to get someone that is right because it's a lifetime appointment? This is not someone that we're going to be able to get rid of if they don't do a good job. And especially when it is the first time, when you are breaking through a glass ceiling, when you are somehow the breakthrough of anything, it's got to be the right person. And I would love to see it happen if it's the right person. I think that growth in America comes from things like this. But when you say it's going to be the right person, but it's going to be a black woman, we have this is something where we've got to get this right. And right by my standards and right by Joe Biden's standards might be two different things. But the person that comes to mind for people is the vice president, Vice President Harris. She was on the Judiciary Committee, a lawyer. She's been a, you know, she's worked in as a attorney general, I believe, in the state, or she's got a background in prosecution. And so in the minds of people on that side of the political aisle, she would line up ideologically with Breyer. Would she be the right choice? And politically speaking, I'll tell you what that does is it answers a lot of questions and it also solves a lot of issues that are happening with this president politically. I'm not accusing him of dumping her. I'm not saying that. But we know politically there have been questions in the past, especially the past 4 or 5 months, about whether or not she was going to be on the ticket. She was even asked in an NBC interview, are you going to be on the ticket in 2024? And she did not say absolutely, yes, I am. She said, I'm not even thinking about 24. The president of the United States said unequivocally in his press conference last week that she is definitely going to be the nominee. So there have been questions. So there's a lot here that's going on. And is she the right person for the court? I look at jurists on the Supreme Court differently than a lot of people do. I don't hate Justice Roberts like a lot of conservatives hate Justice Roberts because they believe he should have been more conservative. I don't hate Sotomayor because she's so liberal. I just think that that's the wrong thing to do. When you look at what and I think Roberts was one of the people that made a statement that said what the Supreme Court is supposed to be. Chief Justice Roberts made a comment about Obamacare back in the Obama administration when there was a Supreme Court fight about some of the rules with Obamacare. And he voted with the liberals on the court and he infuriated and made a lot of Republicans angry. It wasn't how he voted that I agreed with. It was what he said. And what he said I'm paraphrasing is it's not our job to judge whether or not a law is good or bad. Our job is to judge whether or not it's constitutional. And if it's not constitutional, then it can't be in there. If it is constitutional, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad, if I think it's good or bad. And he said, if you don't want bad laws, stop electing bad lawmakers. And I agree with that principle absolutely. When you have activist judges, and it's almost impossible not to say, is this good or bad? I read a story about the Supreme Court shooting down OSHA's authority, and somebody had complained about what Breyer was saying and others. And it wasn't about whether or not it was a good thing to mandate vaccines in companies that had over 100 employees. What it was about was whether or not that agency of the federal government had that power, because it has a much bigger effect. It sets a precedent moving forward. If you say OSHA has the authority to mandate vaccines for employees in companies that have more than 100 employees, then you are setting a precedent that the government has a lot of power to tell companies and businesses what they can do. And when the courts weighed that, they said, no, you don't. And by the majority, I can't remember if it was 5-4 or 6-3, they voted to get rid of the OSHA, say that OSHA doesn't have that authority. They overstepped. That's different than having a personal opinion that says companies should make their employees get vaccinated. You can believe that, but not believe in the mechanism that was used to try to force it to happen. That's what a jurist is supposed to do. Now, whether they get it right or wrong, we all debate that. We talk about a liberal court. People say now it's a 6-3 advantage for conservatives. But if you look at the voting record, Republicans have been upset by the voting record of what was supposed to be conservative justices on some time. So it's going to be a confusing process. The big question is, will Vice President Harris be the nominee? She fits all the criteria of this president, but will it be her? It should be a fascinating time as this moves forward. And then the other question was, will she break the tie if it's 50-50? Because that's what her job would be. Coming up just after 11 o'clock, we go back to talking about the economy and great news and outlook for the state of Arizona. All that's happening next.